This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. In his campaign for the presidency, Joe Biden played up his long career as a centrist, a champion of bipartisanship. At the same time, he advanced an agenda that, on paper anyway, was in many ways more progressive than Barack Obama's. It was not an easy balancing act at all, but Biden managed to unite the Democratic Party and beat Donald Trump. But while the Democrats won back the White House, the Democrats also lost a dozen seats in the House of Representatives. Centrists in the party were quick to lay the blame on progressives. Terms like democratic socialism and defunding the police, they said, had scared away moderate voters. Progressives, on the other hand, say that the energy that they brought to the campaign is exactly what pushed Donald Trump out of the White House. So today I'm going to talk to two members of Congress who are on opposing sides of this debate. Ayanna Pressley, who represents a district in the Boston area, and Abigail Spanberger, who was just reelected in Virginia. When Spanberger won in 2018, it was the first time a Democrat had taken her district, the Virginia 7th, in decades. So let's begin at the beginning.
Absolutely.
You had a conference call with the Democratic caucus, and you were not happy. You were not happy with the use of the word socialism, Democratic or otherwise, and certainly not happy with the term defund the police, because you were convinced that it made your political life perilous and the political lives of a lot of members perilous and may have hurt the Democratic Party this time around. A lot of people disagree with you. Make your case.
I'm a Democrat because I believe in our policies. And I'm a Democrat because in the face of calls for change across our country, because of real challenges facing people, because of the death of Breonna Taylor, because of the death of George Floyd, we in the House of Representatives put together a bill that is, frankly, the compilation of things that my colleagues have been working on for years: banning no-knock warrants, reforming qualified immunity, banning chokeholds, investing in training for our police departments and in community policing programs. And we voted and passed a tremendous piece of legislation, the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act. And so, you know, my comments and what it is that I have talked very openly within my caucus about is that we have good policies. And it's unfortunate when we're talking about what we as legislators are advocating for and are working towards, that we're missing the opportunity to make sure people know that when there are calls for change sweeping our country and calls for reform sweeping our country, that we've acted on them.
So then, to put a pin in it, as they say endlessly now, what's the space between you and somebody like Ayanna Pressley or Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez on issues like this? Or is it our fault, the press, or is it, as it so often is? What's the space between you?
From a policy standpoint, I think, you know, looking at this particular piece of legislation, there's no space, you know, and I think that in various different districts, to be clear, you know, we are advocating for and supporting a bill like this that is tremendous in terms of the types of reforms and improvements that it would create. But when we're looking across the country, and I say we as legislators, be it, you know, someone like Ayanna, or be it someone, you know, from, you know, anywhere across the country, you know, we're looking to build coalitions to bring people together in common cause.
And so in your view, what you were angry about is the kind of rhetoric of it, the politics of it.
The rhetoric of it, and I guess the politics of it, but it's easy for us as legislators to use slogans that our, you know, politically aligned folks are using, right? But it isn't speaking to the policy. And for people who want and are demanding change and reforms, I think we have a responsibility to say, in fact, these, in response to calls for action, these are the policies that we're putting forth.
Well, let's talk about bipartisanship. Joe Biden has been in Washington for decades, and he repeatedly looks back fondly on an era in which there was a such thing as bipartisanship, whether that was reality or fantasy or something in between. You can debate that. But we have been living through 4 years in which the Republican Party has been incredibly loyal to Trump and Trumpism, including the worst of Trump, which is, takes in a lot of area. How is it going to be possible on a dime on January 20th for there suddenly to be great cooperation between the Democratic Party and a Republican Party that has been, with some exceptions, but not many, really obedient and loyal to Trump and Trumpism?
So I think it becomes a question of how much do we want to govern? We shouldn't accept a notion that we only govern when the House, the Senate, and the White House are held by one party. You know, in my district, I represent a district that has historically voted for Republicans. I'm the first Democrat elected since 1968. And I represent people who disagree with me on a whole host of issues.
Does that make you feel constantly imperiled?
You know, I had a really good life before I ran for Congress.
That sounds like a yes.
A
healthy version of yes.
And I had a really good life before I got to Congress. I love the job that I'm able to do serving the district I grew up in, serving people. I love what is, in fact, often a challenge of talking to people who may not agree with me and working to be accountable and explain, this is why I'm advocating for this issue, this is why it's important, and bringing people to either, in some cases, agree with me when they, you know, initially might not have agreed with what is perceived to be a Democratic idea in terms of, you know, partisanship, or at least when people still disagree with me, don't disagree with me just because I'm a Democrat, but they disagree with me because they disagree with the you know, what it is that I'm actually advocating for.
Your remarks about socialism and defund the police as imperiling remarks were leaked. It was a conference call. Did you not expect it to be leaked on such a large conference call? Did you feel betrayed by that?
Listen, I come from the CIA.
That's what surprised me.
People have asked me that question before, and you know, I had, if we are to, as the Democratic Party, have conversations about, you know, what went right, what went wrong, what we should be doing moving forward, you know, I do think it's fair that I would have expected that none of my colleagues or none of their staff members who might have been on the call would leak, you know, notably.
So you were speaking in effect publicly and you didn't mind that it was leaked.
No, I minded very, very much. I wasn't speaking publicly. I caveated my comments heavily with the fact that it was meant for my colleagues, and I expected them to not leak them. And you know, notably, it was a 2.5-hour phone conversation or caucus call where the majority of the call were people echoing the exact same comments as mine. So, you know, it's unfortunate that those comments. It's very unfortunate that those comments were leaked. But, you know, what I'm focused on are the policies that matter. And we are sent to Washington by people who trust us to do the right thing, who trust us to advocate on their behalf. And on issues of, you know, going back to the beginning part of your conversation, on issues of justice and equity, like, we put forth good legislation, and that's what we should be talking about, the policy. When it comes to COVID relief, people need to know that there are many people who continue to fight for and work towards ensuring another relief bill, because that's what people need, that's what families need, that's what school kids need, that's what localities need, that's what small business owners need, and overall, our larger economy needs it.
The package that you're working on has no stimulus checks in it.
It is purely relief. Yeah.
A lot of people need immediate material relief in this pandemic. And if they don't see it, what are the odds that they're going to show up and vote Democratic in 2022?
So I think we're mixing a whole variety of things. One, people need immediate relief. We also need stimulus checks. I've been an advocate for stimulus checks. At this point, the relief bill that we've worked on that currently has bicameral and bipartisan support does not include stimulus checks. It is fully relief, and the relief is extended unemployment, additional unemployment dollars each week from the federal complementing state dollars, the inclusion of gig workers, of course, support to employers through the PPP program. so they can keep people employed. And that the inclusion here of programs that are meant to focus on relief, this does not negate a need for additional stimulus, and it certainly doesn't stop anyone, myself included, from continuing to advocate for, well, what's the next step when it comes to stimulus? Even President-elect Biden has talked about this package as being, I believe he referred to it as a down payment for what comes next. And I would agree with that. This is about the immediacy of relief when so many of the programs created under the CARES Act are set to expire at the end of the month. But it does not negate, nor does it stop people like me from continuing to talk about the need for stimulus as well.
Congresswoman Abigail Spanberger, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on.
Abigail Spanberger represents the 7th District of Virginia. She was elected in 2018. So was Ayanna Pressley. Pressley represents a distinctly liberal district, the Massachusetts 7th. And she's one of four high-profile progressive women in Congress, including Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who some refer to as the Squad. There's a $908 billion COVID relief package in Congress. Where are you on that bill? And what else might you like to see in it?
Well, there's no language or anything immediately before me right now to react to. What I continue to fight for is direct cash relief and assistance, reoccurring payments for the American people, because that's what my constituents tell me they need. When I ask them, well, what will you do with those funds? They say, pay my rent, pay for diapers, pay for insulin, pay for an inhaler, pay for groceries. So they need direct reoccurring cash payments. We also need to cancel a rent and mortgage. We need eviction and foreclosure moratoriums. We need to extend and expand unemployment benefits. And might I add, our immigrant neighbors have been excluded from all of this relief. And meanwhile, this pandemic has, although it has disproportionately hit some communities more than others, and that includes immigrant communities, the hurt has been felt by everyone. And so the relief must be felt by everyone. We can leave no one behind. We also need massive federal investments in municipal and state aid as well to support their relief efforts, as well as the infrastructure needed for vaccine distribution. So these are the things that I will continue to fight for until the very end.
Now, how do you respond to moderate members of your party, people that range from Abigail Spanberger of Virginia to Barack Obama, who said that the phrase and possibly the policy defunding the police is damaging to the overall Democratic Party effort?
I wish people were as offended about defund education as they are this slogan, because in fact, we have seen a defunding of public education for decades, which has created an ecosystem whereby the most marginalized have been pushed to do survivalist things that have later been criminalized, resulting in mass incarceration. Look, first responders have a role to play in our society, but they needn't play a role in every part of our society. Neither do they want to. Rather than deploying the police to the home of someone battling mental illness who is having an episode, we should instead be deploying social workers. Rather than investing, as we have for the last two decades, $1 billion, that's with a B, in growing our school police force, when every child, when every student does not even have equitable access to a school nurse, social worker, or guidance counselor. So we know what works. We simply haven't funded it.
What you describe is profound change, real change, reform. And I'm not sure that somebody like Barack Obama would argue with that. What he would argue is that the phrase defunding the police is politically poisonous for the Democrats. There's a difference, I think.
The Black Lives Matter movement is the modern day civil rights movement. And I am certain that many of the policy mandates and signs that were carried at that time were considered equally disruptive and perhaps offensive to some. Anytime you are disrupting the status quo, anytime you are ushering in a paradigm shift, anytime you are truly being progressive, you are going to be met with that. I would urge us to not be bogged down in a debate about language that allows us to get distracted from the work that we must be doing to respond to the brutality, the lynching, the surveying, the profiling, and the murders of unarmed Black Americans for generations. If you really believe that Black lives matter, thank you for your tweet. Thank you for the hashtag. Thank you for your t-shirt that you perhaps did not even purchase from a Black-owned business.
Right.
But the only receipts that matter right now are policies and budgets. And if it feels uncomfortable to codify that Black lives are a value in budgets, to enshrine that in our laws, it is because we have never done it before. From redlining to unequal access to the GI Bill to the war on drugs.
Do you feel that the moderate or more moderate wing of the party, so-called, is disrespecting the work of progressive activists and politicians?
No, I respect all of, I'll say this, I respect all of my colleagues. You know, these narratives that are pushed in the public square are predictable and par for the course. Again, to be a progressive is to, by your very nature, to be doing the work of making people uncomfortable. At the end of the day, unity is not the goal. Justice is.
Unity is overrated in some sense.
The goal is justice. And if we are all centering the people, we will get exactly where we need to get.
President-elect Biden has repeatedly expressed his faith that with Donald Trump out of the picture, Republican members of Congress will suddenly be open to working with him. Is he dreaming?
Well, listen, it is reprehensible that there have not been more conscientious objectors, you know, true patriots, mm-hmm. Both of the policies of this administration, their corruption, and now this unpatriotic delegitimizing of the election and unwillingness to have a peaceful transfer of power. I will say that bipartisanship is a talking point. The goal, again, must be a centering the people and responding accordingly to their needs.
When you say it's a talking point, sorry to linger on this, but it's so important to going forward now. If it's merely a talking point, that suggests that it's, in practical terms, with the composition of the Congress being what it is, an impossibility, and will make your fondest hopes or anyone's fondest hopes for a truly transformational legislative agenda impossible.
Well, I don't think anything is impossible. I believe in the capacity of our democracy and of people and of community and of movements. I'm doing everything in my power right now to regain control of the Senate so we can stop the obstructionist actions of this GOP-led Senate of the last 4 years. They have been obstructionists in every regard, most notably in standing in the way for us to pass a comprehensive relief package to meet the scale and scope of this hurt. Instead, they approved 222 federal far-right-leaning judges. And now they are once again focused on corporations and pushing this corporate liability shield rather than being focused on the American people. When I talk to workers, you know what they tell me? I don't want to sue my employer. I want to survive. So I'm an eternal optimist, and I don't want to say that bipartisanship is an impossibility or an improbability. If we remain focused on the people, then we will get to where we need to get to.
Congresswoman, with Donald Trump gone on January 20th, what is the pitch to inspire voters who are not the converted, especially people in something like a Georgia runoff?
I think the ultimate persuasion tool is impact. Again, this hurt is being felt by everyone. Again, we know before the pandemic, families did not even have $400 saved to weather a disruptive life event. And I'm sure many of those families were Republicans. So the ultimate persuasion tool is impact. We have to continue to center the people. We have to continue to center justice.
Representative Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
I remember one time we had a conversation. He said to me, he said, "Yo, man, do you got any feelings?" So I'm like, "Wow, what are you talking about? Do I got feelings?"
That's Eric Smokes talking with his friend David Warren.
And he said, because, you know, throughout this whole thing, I haven't seen you cried yet. You know, we got convicted, we came from state, and I still haven't seen you cry. And I told him, no, I did my share of crying, but I couldn't cry in front of you.
Eric Smokes and David Warren both live in Brooklyn. They're middle-aged now, but they've been close since they were in their teens.
Eric was a friend of my brother's. It seemed like he was more older and mature, and he was like, guide me. Certain things I'll be doing, like say if I'm doing something I ain't supposed to be throwing a rock across the street. Hey, yo, what are you doing? Stop that. Come over here. You know, that sort of thing. He always looked out for me.
For most of the time that they've known each other, Eric and David were in prison. In 1987, they were convicted of second-degree murder during a mugging, and it's a crime that they maintain that they didn't commit. Staff writer Jennifer Gonerman has reported on their case for The New Yorker, and she finds the evidence that they were innocent compelling. Here's Jennifer Gonerman.
Eric Smokes and David Warren were best friends growing up in one of Brooklyn's poorest neighborhoods, two black teenagers in East New York. If you look at photographs of them from the time, Eric was the tall, husky one. David was smaller and shorter and looks much younger.
We used to go to the park.
Yeah, we did a lot of neighborhood things.
Yeah, you know, go to the park.
Hang out in the community.
Hang out in the community.
You know, you mess with girls, you mess with guys, yeah. you just do the neighborly thing.
Yeah.
You know, so that was real popular for us.
And crack a lot of jokes.
Yeah. Oh, we did that.
Yeah, we
did
cracked jokes. Yeah. That was our thing. You know?
Yeah, that was what kept us going.
Yeah.
We just hung out. We just hang out. Hanging loose, as you say.
New Year's Eve 1986, going into 1987, Eric Smokes, David Warren, and several of their friends traveled on the subway from Brooklyn to Midtown Manhattan to Times Square.
It's the New Year's Eve ball, all dressed up in 180 red lights, looking like the flashy city it represents, the Big Apple. And here we are at the crossroads of the world, Times Square.
So we arrived in Manhattan around 10 o'clock or so that night.
It's Times Square on New Year's Eve. The streets are packed. There are a few 100,000 people there, shoulder to shoulder, everybody waiting for the ball to drop.
We ended up at Latin Quarters. It was a nightclub for teenagers.
30 seconds. The ball is coming down.
When they got there, they said they realized the prices for the club had been raised for New Year's Eve and they could not afford to get in. So they just hung around outside, watched the people go by. And then they said they eventually headed downtown and made their way back home to Brooklyn.
So that was about it for us. Just, you know, being in the city, enjoying the atmosphere and moving around as best we could because it was very crowded. So it wasn't like you could easily go from one point to the next.
3, 2, 1. Happy New Year, everybody. Happy New Year, boys.
And we come home, next thing you know, they take me in for questioning.
The police wanted to know about a crime committed a few minutes after midnight on New Year's Day. A French tourist by the name of Jean Cass had been mugged, knocked down and his head smashed against the sidewalk. And ultimately, 10 hours later in a hospital, he passed away. The next day, the police caught several young people mugging a man not far from Times Square. The police had been told that they should interrogate anyone arrested for robbery to see if they knew about the murder. Now, one of the mugging suspects, a 16-year-old named James Walker, gave the police a name, another teenager, whom he called Smokey.
As I'm crossing the street, a van pulls up in front of us, and the officers jump out and call my name, hey, Smokey, because my last name is Smoke, so most people refer to me as Smokey. So he's Smokey, so I'm like, let me keep walking, because something, you know, I felt something wasn't right about this.
And for me, it was my mother came to get me, said some police wanted me. So I said, police want me.
And when you were at the police precinct, did you have anybody with you, a parent or a lawyer?
Nobody was there with me, just me. When I was first being questioned, they was asking me, well, we know it was an assault that occurred in Manhattan, at this place, at this time. And I was like, I don't know anything about that. So they kept going on. Well, from there, it went from assault to a murder. Oh, well, you know, the guy died and you're going to get charged with this. You're never going to see the light of day again. And I was like, well, that doesn't still change my answer. I don't know anything about this. And then they start saying like, well, you know, your buddy's telling on you. And I start, you know, to myself, I'm like, telling on me about what? I know it was had to be a lie.
One fact about their interrogations that is important. They both told the cops the same story.
On the facts and the evidence that they had, they could have pinned this on any number of young black guys in the city because they didn't get anybody at the scene who was able to make an ID.
That's James Henning, a lawyer who represents Eric Smokes and David Warren today.
So what you have is you have a group of teenagers who are brought in for an interrogation on a homicide. And you've got an officer who's got his first ever assigned homicide, and he doesn't believe he's going to close it. And then out of the blue, he gets this kid who seemingly hands him Eric Smokes, who to him sounds like, you know, this is the guy.
Just 7 days after Mr. Cass was killed, the police arrested Eric Smokes and David Warren and charged them with his murder. It was an extraordinarily quick timeline. The police had started with no leads and then seemingly wrapped up in just 1 week. Eric was 19 and David was 16, and over the next few months, a prosecutor offered David various plea deals. They were all contingent on him testifying against his best friend. If he pointed the finger at Eric, his own punishment would be minimal.
If I'm not mistaken, the last offer was a year, you know, and that basically at that time, I could just went home. But of course, I had to turn it down because I'm not going to say he did something I know he didn't do. And I'm not going to say I did something I know I didn't do.
At the time that of the arrest and we going through back and forth to court, you know, through that time period there, I was like, ain't nobody going to come to court and say we did this because we didn't do it. So I was to tell my lawyer, listen, we can go to trial now, tomorrow, whatever. And I'm not taking no plea deal. Like I spoke that to him early on. Like, I'm not plea dealing this. I don't have nothing to do with it. I have nothing to worry about. So when we got to trial and then they bring forth these people and they saying these things, it was like,
unbelievable.
Like, wow. Yeah, we looked at like, do you know him? We was asking each other, do you know this person? The only person that we can say we knew was James Walker.
James Walker was an acquaintance, a friend of a friend. And by this point, he had cut a deal with prosecutors that allowed him to avoid prison time on his own mugging case if he testified at their trial.
That was the thing that always got me. What made you pick me and Eric out of all the people in the world?
The police also relied on the testimony of four other young men who claimed that they had seen the two at the crime scene. And when I went back and read the trial transcript from 1987, it was really jarring to see the level of pressure that had been placed by police on some of these witnesses. The police had to use what's called material witness warrants, meaning that they arrested them and took them into custody in order to bring them to court and force them to testify. In at least one case, they held one of these young men in jail overnight to make sure that he testified so that in the morning they could pick him up from the jail and bring him to the courthouse and put him on the witness stand. When the jurors came back after deciding on a verdict, they told the judge, "We would like the court to know that we did not come to a decision lightly, but with great emotional turmoil."
I remember when the decision was rendered and they was escorting us out to court, told us to stand up or whatever, he just sat there. I had to hit him and say, "Yo, come on." Because it didn't register to him that we was found guilty, but we had to leave now. And when we went back into the holding pens, the conversation was like, "They really convicted us?" Like, unbelievable. Like, he was, like, totally lost on that.
David Warren got 15 years to life. Eric Smokes was given 25 years to life. And at that sentencing hearing, Eric shouted out, "I've been framed." Eric and David were both sent off to prisons in upstate New York, They were among the youngest people in the New York State prison system. And for most of their incarceration, the two were held at separate prisons, so they couldn't actually see each other or call each other on the phone, but they would write to each other regularly, about once a month.
He used to write me and be like, why did they do this to us? And I'd be like, you asking me, like, I got the answer to it. I do not know.
And we realized, early on, we realized that all we had was us, mm-hmm. really. You know, we definitely had our family, you know, a few extended people out there who was on our side or what have you. But for the most part, we knew we had us. We had to believe in our union, in our bond. It was like a marriage almost, you know.
Both men tried to appeal their convictions, but their appeals went nowhere. And the years slowly ticked by. 1988, 1989, 1990, 1995. To pass the time, Eric started lifting weights in the prison yard and realized he had a real aptitude for it. He became known as one of the strongest men in the prison system. But for David, surviving in prison was much, much more difficult because he was smaller, shorter, younger. What kind of strategies inside did you use to hold on to your sanity?
Well, I'll be honest, about 97, 98, I lost all focus of being like, oh, we're going to get out of here. Somehow this situation's going to be rectified. And it became like, okay, I got 4 years left before I see the parole board. When Eric used to be like, what we going to do about the case? I used to be like, man, I don't want to talk about that. I really didn't because of all the negativity that this case had brought to me.
In 2005, after the two had been locked up for 18 years, Eric Smokes got a letter one day, and on the return address, he could see the name James Walker.
You know, mail call came around about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. The officer came by, put a letter on my gate. I think I was locked in my cell at that time. So I see the name. I'm like, wow. I don't know what to expect from this. You know, this might be a pipe bomb or something. He apologized for lying on us at the time of trial to say, you know, what he said against us. And he was asking how it is that he can, you know, repair things. How can he fix things?
I told Eric, I don't want anything to do with that guy. You conjured up a whole story. You just told this fantastic tale to these officers.
That's David Warren with his friend Eric Smokes. The story of their fight to prove their innocence continues in just a moment. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. If you're just joining us, we're hearing the story of two men sent to prison for a murder that occurred when they were teenagers in the late 1980s. They maintain their innocence to this day. David Warren and Eric Smokes were convicted largely on the testimony of another teenager named James Walker, whose charges on an unrelated crime were reduced in exchange for giving this testimony. 18 years later, Walker wrote a letter apologizing for lying to the police and implicating them in the crime. Staff writer Jennifer Gonerman has been reporting on Smokes and Warren's effort to clear their names.
Okay, so this letter from James Walker recanting his testimony is the kind of thing that anyone who is trying to overturn his conviction would dream of receiving. Here on paper, he's apologizing for lying on the witness stand and explaining he doesn't know why he chose to give police Eric Smokes' name. Quote, honestly, I don't know why I did it, he wrote. One might think that this letter would be enough to overturn the men's convictions, that it wouldn't be that long before Eric and David walked out of prison as free men. But that's not what happened at all. Eric wrote to every lawyer and legal clinic he could think of, begging for help, trying to find somebody to represent him pro bono, and he included copies of Walker's letter. But in the end, he couldn't find any lawyer willing to take on his case. Their efforts to get their convictions thrown out had gone nowhere, and they were running out of options. They knew that the only way they were ever going to get out of prison was to persuade the parole board to release them. Tell me what it's like to be locked up, to be insisting on your innocence, and then having to go before the parole board. What is that experience like?
For me, doing research from all the guys that I was incarcerated with that knew my story, they told me, you have two options. You can maintain your innocence, and we know you're innocent, and stay in here with us forever. Or you have to, you can say that you did something that you know you didn't do and try to get home. And it was a gut-wrenching decision for me it weighed on me heavily. To this day, it still weighs on me, that I had to make. And I chose to try to go home because I felt like I was between the rock and the hard place.
There's a phenomenon called the innocent prisoner's dilemma.
That's one of their attorneys, James Henning, again.
Where it's how do you explain and show empathy for something that you did not do? And that's what you're facing in going to the parole board where you're an Eric Smoltz or a David Warren. And the nature of the beast with parole is that if you do not show remorse, you're most likely, almost certainly not going to receive parole.
Eric and David each had life on the back of their sentences, which meant that they might have to spend the rest of their lives in prison. There was only one way to avoid this fate, and that was to persuade the parole board to release them. They said they felt they had no choice but to lie. They said they took responsibility for the crime. And in the end, they got to go home.
That was a necessary evil in order for me to get out. I mean, I struggled with coming to that conclusion or having to accept responsibility, but the uneasiness I had about it didn't override my need for being free.
David left prison in 2007 after about 20 years of being away, and Eric got parole in 2011 after 24 years. Eric and David had gone on trial as teenagers, and if David had decided to cooperate with law enforcement, if he had testified against Eric at trial, he never would have spent his entire adult life in a prison upstate. But he didn't hold that against Eric in any way. Instead, the two men stuck together. And when they came out 2 decades later, they were still good friends. And this next part is pretty astonishing. 20 years after they went to prison, both men ended up marrying the same women who had been their teenage girlfriends at the time they were arrested.
My wife was my girlfriend at the time of arrest. And the same
she
with
was
him.
My girlfriend at the time of arrest.
Yeah. So that's, you know, ain't that something? That's happenstance or something. I don't know. What would they call it? I don't know what they call it.
Destiny?
Destiny. Yeah, that was destiny, I guess. You know, because we didn't foresee that.
And when David had a daughter, he asked Eric to be her godfather.
You try to put it all together, like, because I have a young daughter. And for me to try to explain all of this to her, it's exhausting for me. So imagine for a child 8 years old, because she want to know, why did they put you and goddaddy in jail?
How did you decide to find attorneys and continue your fight to clear your name even after you got out of prison? Few people do that.
Like, our whole relationship is really predicated on big brother, little brother. And in life, you know, in the perfect world, the big brother always look out for the little brother. So that's why I couldn't give up. That's why when I got out, I couldn't let it go. You know, they would question, they being a district attorney or maybe just random people in general would question, why would you want to talk to a witness that, you know, testified against you? Why wouldn't I? I said, I'm innocent. Why wouldn't I want to talk and say, why would you do this to me? Why wouldn't I want to know?
In 2018, Eric and David finally got a hearing in front of a judge in state Supreme Court. Now all the evidence in their case would get a second look. It was sort of like a murder trial in reverse. The lead detective and prosecutors from the original trial were now back in the courtroom on the witness stand being cross-examined. Witnesses who had testified against them in 1987 were called back into court too. But this time, two key witnesses who claimed to have seen Eric and David at the crime scene now recanted. saying they had lied in 1987 because they had been pressured by law enforcement. But James Walker, the man most responsible for sending Eric and David to prison, couldn't testify. He had died 1 year earlier.
When he died, we was like, you know, like the wind from under our sails was taken away. But, you know, at the same time, we still knew we had the letters and we had his affidavit. So we believed that that right there would sustain us.
While Eric and David's murder trial had taken about a week, this hearing dragged on over the course of more than a year, with court dates held only occasionally. By the end, Eric was now 52 years old, and David was 49.
How you doing?
Good. How you doing?
How you
Eric?
Feeling?
Good.
All right. I'm well.
Pretty how, well. You, how are you feeling?
I'm well. I'm well. You know, a little anxious, but you know what? You know, it's to be expected, I guess. You know.
On a cold January morning at the beginning of 2020, before the pandemic here, I met Eric and David on a sidewalk in front of a courthouse in Lower Manhattan. On this day, the judge was to announce his decision.
What would you predict is going to happen if you had to guess?
Well, I don't want to be a... I don't really want to win. Okay. He said win.
Predicted I'm
going
to win.
Win. Okay.
We went inside, up the elevator, and everybody packed into a small courtroom. Eric and David were there with their lawyers, sitting in front of the judge. Their families were behind them. There were a few reporters.
This is calendar number 3, indictment 249 of 1987. Eric Smokes and David Warren.
And then the judge, Stephen Antignotti, walked in and started to speak.
My sort of thought process is laid out in great detail in my decision, which is approximately 125 pages long. The court has not been persuaded. Accordingly, defendant CPL motion under 440.
He denied their motion. He denied their request to vacate their murder convictions.
It don't get no better. Don't think it get easier as the fight continues, especially when you get denial after denial after denial, knowing the truth.
I was disgusted from the arrest date of January 8th, 1987 until now, and it hasn't gotten no better. So how do I feel? I'm angry.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you, guys.
It kind of crushed me, especially my young daughter, seeing her emotions. I couldn't believe it, but the only good thing that I can say about that is that we didn't have to return to a cell after the decision.
Yeah.
So they can't put me back into a cell.
In his decision, the judge zeroed in on what they had said before the parole board years earlier. He wrote that their testimony taking responsibility for the crime was, as he put it, compelling evidence of their guilt.
You know, it's disheartening to know that we had to go through this to get to this point. You know, you got to walk the journey or perish. So we had to keep our eyes open and see every and experience every obstacle that was before us and figure our way around it.
I think the system is intensely resistant to admitting mistakes. I mean, what prosecutor, detective, or judge really wants to think, even for 1 minute, that they made a mistake and sent the wrong man to prison for 20 years? Can you imagine having that on your conscience? And there's also often an intense resistance to saying that your colleagues might have made that same kind of mistake too. But the only way for Eric and David to try to clear their names was to ask the same DA's office that had prosecuted them and the same court system that had sent them to prison to go back and reinvestigate their case. As Eric once put it to me, we're beholden to the courts. We don't have a choice. And now their only recourse is to seek justice within that very same system once again. Their lawyers are doing just that, but this time it will be an even tougher uphill battle to try to clear their names.
So, you know, every day we think about this. Every day that we speak to one another, that's...
That topic come up.
Topic of discussion. That's got to come up.
Mm-hmm. Even going through the hearings, coming home some days, it was hard for me to process it, and I had to come home and sit down for a minute just to get my bearings together, look at my wife, look at my daughter, and say, yo, you're free. Let it go. because it eats at my soul.
David Warren and Eric Smokes are working on an appeal. And Jennifer Gonerman is a staff writer who covers criminal justice. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Margaret Atwood is the author of The Handmaid's Tale and many other novels. She's just come out with her first collection of poetry in more than a decade, and it's called Dearly. We recently published in The New Yorker a poem of hers called Flatline.
Flatline. Things wear out. Also, fingers. Gnarling sets in. Your hands crouch in their mittens. Forget chopsticks and buttons. Feet have their own agendas. They scorn your taste in shoes and ignore your trails, your maps. Ears are superfluous. What are they for, those alien pink flaps? Skull fungus. The body, once your accomplice, is now your trap. The sunrise makes you wince. Too bright, too flamingo. After a lifetime of tangling, of knotted snares and lacework, of purple headspace tornadoes with their heart race and rubble, you crave the end of mazes and pray for a white shore, an ocean with its horizon. Not so much bliss, but a flat line you steer for. No more hiss and slosh. No reefs, no deeps, no throat rattle of gravel. It sounds like this.
That's Margaret Atwood reading Flatline. She'll talk about the poem in her new collection, Dearly, with poetry editor Kevin Young on the next episode of the New Yorker's Poetry Podcast.
Is it silence that it sounds like? Blankness?
That's right.
or is it mystery?
Well, both. I think silence always has mystery in it because being us, we're waiting for what sound is going to come in to fill that silence. What's going to happen next? That is the way we are.
Do you feel like it's befriending silence in the poem or befriending this process, or is it complaining or both?
Oh, no, I think it's acknowledging.
Uh-huh. I think it's defiant too, though. There's something about it. Skull fungus, one of my favorite lines.
Is it?
that is sort of playful too. It isn't simply, you know, conceding. What do you think?
I don't know. I don't think it's particularly defiant, except insofar as writing a poem about something you may not particularly wish for is defiant.
That's from the New Yorker Poetry Podcast, hosted by Kevin Young. You can subscribe wherever you go for podcasts. I'm David Remnick, and that's our program. I want to thank you for joining us. See you soon.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of TuneYards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.